That's The Touch with Deli G in the mix every Saturday night from 9 o'clock on Bristol's number one community station, BCFM 93.2.
You can keep it live. Keep it on.
On BCFM.
These are the people who operate Britain's system of government. Judges, coroners, civil servants, police chiefs, permanent private secretaries, members of the secret services and privy councillors.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Useless are the Russian Secret Service if they really left a trail of radioactive polonium to their hotel and all the way to Moscow and back. Yes, the so-called public inquiry, which wasn't public, and it wasn't a judicial inquiry. It's managed by ministers into the death of former Russian spy Alexander Litvinenko and the book he wrote, Blowing Up Russia. Which was all about the 1999 bomb attacks in Moscow, amongst other things. But his friend, also Russian oligarch Boris Berezovsky, what was his link to Litvinenko? And Berezovsky's strange admiration for the Queen's cousin, Prince Michael of Kent. Why did Boris pay the Duke over £300,000 before his untimely death in 2013? What's the assassination of Alexander Litvinenko really all about? An MH370, remember the Malaysian airliner that disappeared on its way from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing? More evidence emerging that the real destination was the secretive US airbase of Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean, the Chagos Islands, which the Pentagon is leasing from Britain. Question two, about local firm Rolls-Royce, whether they've been entirely honest with the families of those that disappeared. But let's start with Litvinenko, Martin. There's a major report out yesterday into the suspicious death, the poisoning by polonium of Alexander Litvinenko. What's your take?
Well, as you say, this inquiry is not an independent inquiry. So it's tentative conclusion that this assassination was ordered by Putin has to be taken with a pinch of salt.
So let's have a little look at what's changed with public inquiries over the years, because I know around about the time of the 7/7 London bombings there was an important change to the law, tweaking of how public inquiries operate.
That's right, they're no longer independent and run by judges, they're effectively run in-house by the government, which is why the Pat Finucane Centre in Northern Ireland have insisted that there needs to be an inquiry into collusion between loyalist paramilitaries and the British forces, but it shouldn't be carried out by the British because they've changed the parameters for such inquiries to make them basically tame and whitewashed.
So the parameters of inquiries now are set by ministers?
Yeah. So, in other words, the conclusion of this inquiry is a political conclusion. And then we can, you know, having got that out of the way, we can then start to talk about what may or may not have happened in this particular case. Litvinenko, as I was saying on NTV earlier, Litvinenko's book, Blowing Up Russia, hardly appears in any of the discussions about his murder. The implication of the report and of the inquiry seems to be that because he'd written this book, Blowing Up Russia, that gave the Russian state a motive to assassinate him. But the detailed allegations in the book are very rarely looked into, because in actual fact it's a very interesting episode.
Well, go on then. What's in the book?
Well, in 1998, it was quite clear that the former communists, or the Communist Party of Russia candidate for president, Gennady Zyuganov, was well ahead in opinion polls. because the economy had been looted, people had lost their savings, people were sick of so-called shock therapy.
Is this the
reform.
Yeltsin era we're talking about, with the oligarchs?
The Yeltsin era, the oligarchy, the new as they're called in Russia, they'd managed to snaffle most of the, crown jewel national assets,
the oil. So this is a sort of privatisation to the oligarchs of a lot of the national assets.
Yeah, that's right. And also, of course, the collapse in people's living standards. If there is a collapse in the banking system, which I think is going to happen this year, then we will probably have to go through similar pain as the people in Russia did, where at the same time as you lose your job and there is no unemployment benefit, inflation hits 1,000%.
Well, there's a couple of things that
what happens in those circumstances.
There's a couple
of people
things
die.
That helped pull the Russians through, weren't there? There was one which was lots of bartering going on. The other one was the fact that many Russians have relatives with land, dachas and things like that, so they were able to lodge it into grow their own food.
But in actual fact, the death...
Well, a lot of people that came out of the cities, didn't they?
But the death rate in Russia, which was already quite high because it wasn't a particularly healthy society in the first place, shot up through the roof during this period of economic reform. So there was every good reason why the Communist Party might win the election in Russia. Former communists had won the election in Poland, for example, where I was living at the time, even though it was a very anti-Soviet country because people were just fed up with the economic reform. But the oligarchy, of course, were terrified of the possibility that a Communist Party government would come to power. Not only would the assets be taken off them, but they would be prosecuted for stealing them. And in actual fact, that's ultimately what happened to people like Khodorkovsky. So what happened was Berezovsky, who was at that stage a kind of Rupert Murdoch stroke Berlusconi figure in Russian politics.
Yeah, but he didn't just own a TV network, he also owned the Mercedes franchise for. He was one of the people who were making a vast amount of money out of every Mercedes that was sold.
He was the chief oligarch. And the alarm bell started ringing in the oligarchy in Russia when Zyuganov went to Davos. So Zyuganov, the head of the Russian Communist Party, went to Davos, and he was being flooded. Loads of people were coming up to talk to him because they obviously saw him as going to be the man who was going to be leading Russia. And at that point, the oligarchy in Russia, who are basically criminals, got really panicky. What can we do? What can we do? We've got to get rid of this threat. And then, for no reason at all, the Chechens decided they were going to bomb working class housing estates in Ryazan and Moscow, killing hundreds of people over several weeks period. And at the same time, Samuel Bashiev, who was a Chechen militant commander, for some reason decided to lead an attack into Dagestan. Now, again, he had influence. Berezovsky had influence with Basiev, and Basiev was actually acting like a mercenary at that point. So what effectively was happening is that what it looks like, and this is what the book Blowing Up Russia outlines, because Litvinenko was an FSB agent, saying, well, it wasn't the Chechens who planted these bombs to kill all these people. It was, in fact, the Russian Secret Service to blame the Chechens. And the whole purpose of this was to undermine the Communist Party's electoral strategy and to allow a new force to emerge in Russian politics, a centrist sort of security led force led by one Vladimir Putin, who was virtually unknown before these attacks and atrocities took place. And then the strategy worked. The communists lost the election. Putin eventually came to power. But I think what Putin then did is he disciplined the oligarchy. Berezovsky and Putin fell out once Putin was elected, because Putin wasn't going to be Berezovsky's puppet. And eventually Berezovsky was forced out of Russia, came to live in Britain, got political asylum, was feted by the neocons on this side of the water, was very friendly with Dick Cheney and so on, for example. And I would suggest that he is a more likely suspect for the murder of Litvinenko, because Berezovsky was very keen that a harder line be taken on towards Russia than the elites in the West were willing to contemplate.
But, I mean, it's obvious, isn't it, the person who would be most annoyed about the writing of this book blowing up Russia is probably Putin.
Yes, but, I mean, if Putin wanted to assassinate Litvinenko, he wouldn't do it with polonium. He would find some other mechanism to do it. And in actual fact, throughout the Soviet era, there's virtually no... They only ever assassinated people who'd fled from Russia, I think, once or twice. Rupert Allison, the security expert who writes for the Daily Telegraph and so on, he said, well, there's no evidence that the Russians generally behave like that. And I think the use of plutonium was found contaminating Lugovoy and so on, but it was also found in Berezovsky's office, which Lugovoy had never visited. And I would suggest that my copper's hunch about this is that Berezovsky was getting very frustrated because he kept banging on about, we've got to accuse Putin of bombing Moscow. We've got to accuse Putin of bombing Moscow. And we know he did it because I helped him do it. We did it together. Let's accuse him of that. And quite logically, MI6 CIA are saying to him, yes, but you were involved in it as well. So if we accuse Putin, he's just going to counter-accuse you. And what you're also forgetting, Boris Berezovsky, is that we carried out 9/11 and the Russians know all about that. General Ivashov was the commander of the Russian armed forces on 9/11. People can check his stuff on the internet. It's fairly clear that the Russian military are pretty much convinced that that was an inside job. But they haven't used it. That's nuclear weapons. Accusing the CIA, Mossad, of carrying out 9/11, that's nuclear weapons. You can't do a deal with people after you've accused them of that. And, of course, you can't do a deal with Putin after you've accused him of bombing Moscow, especially in the case of Berezovsky, as if you were involved yourself. And at that stage, it's quite likely that MI6 and CIA were very well aware of what was going on and were actually quite happy with it because it kept the communists out of power in Moscow. And it's exactly the same kind of thing that NATO was doing in Italy and Belgium in the 70s and the 80s. The Bologna bomb in 1980 killed 86 people. According to Italian police investigations, that was carried out by NATO intelligence services to stop the Italian Communist Party getting a foothold in the Italian government. So there's actually a track record of intelligence services carrying out these kind of atrocities in order to prevent left-wing political progress. And I think that's exactly what happened in Russia, as it had happened previously in Western Europe, and that Berezovsky eventually became an embarrassment to all, partly because of I think that he would have been the sort of person who would have had access to plutonium on the black market, polonium on the black market. He was then probably the mastermind. He's a very tricksy character.
Well, let's just talk about Berezovsky for a minute, because I know he had Israeli or former Israeli soldiers guarding his property in London, on the door,
very close to the Israeli government,
He was found dead in the bath in 2013, and there was an inquest into him, his death, which was an open verdict. So he left an estate worth nothing, so he'd run out of money. He was also paying, bizarrely, he was paying the Duke of Kent something like £320,000 he paid to the Duke of Kent, the Queen's cousin. When asked about it, he said it was just because I admire him. I think he's a wonderful man.
Yes, so Berezovsky wants to be part of the Western elite. He's chucking his money around. Basically, Berezovsky wanted Putin's role. He wanted to be president of Russia. He saw himself in that role, although he's actually gotten very little political support on the ground in Russia. He never did. He used to be a kind of Rupert Murdoch figure who controlled TV and all the rest of it. But in actual fact, he didn't really have much political skills. But he's a very tricksy, gangsterish type character. And he's basically saying in the book Blowing Up Russia, all the fingers are pointed at Putin. But Berezovsky knew all about this atrocities because it was the oligarchy's strategy to keep the communists from winning the election. That's what that was all about. West were implicated. West knew exactly what happened. They were happy for it to happen.
Family don't believe that he killed himself.
Well, they wouldn't, but I don't think they're not saying that Putin did it either. I think it's more likely that Berezovsky's been bumped off by CIA MI6 because he's becoming an embarrassment and a big mouth. You can't accuse Putin of bombing Moscow without the Russians turning around and saying, well, we're going to dig up everything we've got on what happened on 9/11. General Ivashov here is going to point a finger at people in your armed services who were behind the 9/11 atrocities. Now, we all know in the real world, you don't accuse us of bombing Moscow, and we won't accuse you of 9/11. That's use of nuclear weapons, psychological warfare, nuclear weapons.
So you think,
but I think we're getting closer to the point where all of this is going to come out. It's all going to come out. But of course, the bombing of Moscow in the 1990s was carried out with the collusion of the Western intelligence services. They were friends of Berezovsky. At that stage, Putin was their man, and they were absolutely determined to stop the communists coming to power, even if it cost the lives of hundreds of ordinary working class Moscovites.
So why don't
you
think
Western powers
were
implicated in that?
Why don't you think Sir Robert Owen is right then when he says that Litvinenko was probably murdered on personal orders of Putin?
Because A, it's not a proper inquiry, it's a political inquiry, so it's come to a political conclusion, as we said earlier, and B, if Putin was going to murder Litvinenko, he wouldn't use polonium in this way. Polonium, the British police found traces of polonium at Berezovsky's offices. How did that get there? And the other point is that nobody really has discussed the reason why Litvinenko might have been a target. It's because of the bombings in Moscow and Ryazan. And nobody wants to look too closely at that, because that was actually the oligarchy in Russia covering their backs with the support, no doubt, of MI6 and CIA, because they didn't want to see the return of a communist government in Russia either.
Now, Litvinenko was actually in the pay of MI6. I mean, the BBC reported that, but there's been absolutely no discussion or coverage about that, either in this inquiry or in the mainstream media press coverage this week.
It was denied that he was an MI6 agent, but in actual fact, it's now been conclusively shown that he was, in fact, working for MI6. And if you work for MI6, you can nasty accidents can happen to you. Ask that guy that ended up chopped to pieces in his own holdall, who used to work for the British intelligence services. Who killed him? Putin? I think not.
This financial link between Berezovsky and the Duke of Kent, though, I find it fascinating. Do you think that he was trying to ingratiate himself to the British establishment?
Well, it's only speculation, but that sounds about right. You can imagine that somebody like Berezovsky would identify the Duke of Kent as somebody who was very close to the British establishment, and if he was to keep him sweet, then that might help his own ambitions. He was very much a manipulator and a fixer. And, of course, a main suspect, both in the bombings of Moscow and in the assassination of Litvinenko. Litvinenko was supposedly his protege, but Berezovsky is a very cynical and manipulative character, quite capable, I believe, of killing people close to him in order to achieve certain goals.
Litvinenko is not the only person to die of polonium poisoning either, is he?
Well, no. As far as we know, Yasser Arafat was poisoned by polonium by somebody in his entourage, although that's recently been queried. But in any case...
Well, his body was exhumed and there was polonium found in his body. But it was actually Yasser Arafat's wife that ordered the body to be exhumed in France.
Well, I mean, if I was going to assassinate somebody or murder them, I would only use polonium if I wanted everybody to know that I'd done it as a way of threatening them and intimidating others. If you want to bump people off, there are much more sensible ways of doing it. They can have nasty car accidents. You can poison them with all sorts of things which don't show up. Why use radioactive polonium, which has long acting and it takes ages for them to die, but also leaves loads of traces all over the place?
Well, it's hard to detect. Apparently, that's why. Apparently,
well, it's not hard to detect, is it? Once you know what you're looking for, it leaves a radioactive trace. Well, there's things that are much harder to detect than that.
Polonium 210, the hard to detect poison that killed Alexander Litvinenko. That's a Guardian headline from November 2013, Martin. Just a few milligrams of the highly radioactive isotope was found in Yasser Arafat's body, but it's a lethal dose.
Yes, but I mean, the fact is, why use anything radioactive which can ultimately be traced? If you've got access to somebody where you've got their drink in front of you, you don't drop polonium in it. There's plenty of things you can drop in there. There's loads and loads of things you could use to murder somebody. And relatively slow acting as well.
Okay.
Which are much more difficult to trace.
Let's look at this connection between the proven Yasser Arafat connection with polonium too. Is there any source for polonium that you can think of that might be used in both of those assassinations?
Well, I don't know enough about the black market in this kind of material to say, but I would suggest to you that it's the kind of thing that a non-state actor like Berezovsky, with a lot of money in his pocket, he might be able to get hold of something like that. A state, a real state, would use something much, much more effective and probably more difficult to trace.
Ultimately, do you think the truth is going to come out about this, Litvinenko? And how is it being used geopolitically? This case?
it just piles on the agony of, you know, Russia's a rogue state, etc., etc. And we've already got full sanctions on Russia, idiotic as it is, because of course the sanctions on Russia and the crashing of the oil price by the Saudis is pushing the world economy to the brink of disaster. So we're so determined to bring down the Russian government, but we're going to cut our own throats to do it. Pretty crazy stuff. I think future historians will get to the bottom of a lot of this once the oligarchies in Russia and the West have been put into the dustbin of history.
But what you seem to be saying is that actually lots of intelligence services around the world have got to the bottom of this, but they're using this information as almost like poker cards up their sleeve.
Yeah. Well, I'm pretty certain that most of the world's intelligence services pretty soon after 9/11 worked out what was going on. But if you're the Russian intelligence services or whoever, you don't come blurting out and say, well, we know what's going on here. What you do is go, aha, so that's what you're up to. And you just keep it up your sleeve as a means of private blackmail behind the scenes. And that's pretty much the way the Russians have approached 9/11. They are willing to allow people to accuse the West of false flag terrorism. And General Ivashov, who's been most outspoken, is the retired head of the Russian Armed Forces. He was Chief of Staff Russian Armed Forces on 9/11, but now he's retired. And he speaks very quietly. He very quietly says, from his retirement, well, I don't believe their stories, I think they did it. But he says it very quietly. And the Russian government's position is, we don't believe that sort of thing. It's a silly. I mean, Putin has openly said, oh, I don't credit such theories. But his own head of armed forces quietly saying the opposite. And what's going on there is signalling, isn't it? They're signalling a message to the Western elites. Look, we want to do a deal with you. We know what you did. We want to do a deal with you. Don't accuse us of stuff and we won't accuse you of stuff. Let's do a deal. But everybody, of course, is collecting as much information as they can, because ultimately what may happen, if we do go to open war with Russia, the Russians will come straight out with telephone intercepts and all sorts of other things which prove that the Western intelligence services are involved in 9/11 as a way of kicking away public support for the Western elites as they go to war with Russia.
So are you saying that this whole Litvinenko story, I mean, I must admit, I do contrast it rather with the Gaddafi, Colonel Gaddafi stories, yeah, which were cooked up as kind of part of the hate campaign against Gaddafi, yeah, the attempt to pin the murder of Yvonne Fletcher, which was shown in the Dispatches documentary, two-part Dispatches documentary called Murder in St. James, not to have been from, yeah, the Libyan embassy, proved beyond any shadow of a doubt, really, that the security services had been hiring the building where it looked like the shot had actually come from,
yeah,
and also the Lockerbie bombing, which, as again, an attempt to pin that on Gaddafi, which Alan Frankovich's documentary The Maltese Double Cross showed wasn't the Libyans again. So maybe the whole Litvinenko story is aimed at us, the British public, and British journalists, yeah, and British MPs.
Yeah, but my reading of this is it was probably Berezovsky who killed Litvinenko as a way of trying to force the issue with the Western powers in terms of facing down Putin. They didn't do it, he did it, in order to try and force the issue. But what we always say on this programme, when you see an event like the Charlie Hebdo attack, or the assassination of Litvinenko, or 9/11, or the bombings in Moscow, don't presume that the obvious culprits are the culprits, because what psychological warfare is all about is putting the blame on selected targets. So what often happens is that somebody carries out an attack, like the bombings of Dublin and Monaghan in 1972, which the Irish police are pretty convinced were carried out by MI5. The purpose of that was to put pressure on the government in Dublin to ban Sinn Féin, which they did. So, in other words, when things happen, don't presume that the first story you're told about who did it and why is the truth. And of course it's very difficult to get to the truth when people are determined to play these sinister and sadistic games.
You have just been exposed to a range of propaganda devices used by the West to control, manipulate, neutralize, and anesthetize entire populations.
Okay, Martin, let's go on to talk a bit about the Davos this week, because this is the big conflab of all the rich and powerful over in Switzerland. I mean, we mentioned Switzerland earlier on, didn't we? Mark Wright, the Lib Dem councillor, saying something about the gold, secret hoards of gold kept in Switzerland, not wanting to have the EU fishing around to find out how much and what they've got. We know also that the use of numbered Swiss bank accounts through the ages has been used for paying assassins and this kind of thing. A very handy tool, actually, the Swiss monetary system. And also that the Bank for International Settlements is based there, which is the central banker's central bank, which hardly ever gets a mention on the mainstream media. Maybe we should start with that. And I know, because the BIS in Basel, which was set up after World War I to administer war reparations after the First World War, but then there was an attempt to close it down at the end of World War II because it had been being used to finance Hitler. And also the Nazi regime's foreign exchange was coming from the Bank for International Settlements too. Well, they didn't shut it down. It's still going, and it's now saying a few interesting things about the global economy.
Well, William White, who used to be their chief economist, is saying that we're on the verge of a crash. He's basically saying the sort of thing I've been saying on this show for years.
What he's saying is that the world faces a wave of epic debt defaults. And he's from the Bank for International Settlements, so he should know. I mean, he's now actually the chairman of the OECD's Review Committee. That's the Organisation of Economic and Cooperation and Development.
Yeah, well, I mean, what's happening now, as we saw with George Osborne's little, oh, yes, there's going to be trouble ahead, is that everybody is trying to position themselves so that when the crash comes, they will be able to say, oh, yes, but we knew it was coming and we saw it coming and we knew what was going to happen. Because I think pretty much everybody who's serious realises that it is going to happen now. And, of course, the elite meet in Switzerland because it is, for all the reasons you've enumerated, the sort of place where you can get together all these elites in one place in a convivial, protectable place. Davos is where the rich and powerful go to schmooze.
Well, the interesting thing he said here, and this is from the Daily Telegraph, this week, Ambrose Evans-Pritchard, the world faces a wave of epic defaults, fears the central bank veteran. He says the situation's worse than it was in 2008. Our macroeconomic ammunition to fight downturns is essentially all used up. He's the chairman of the OECD's Review Committee, as I said, former chief economist at the BIS. The emerging markets were part of the solution after the Lehman crisis. Now they're part of the problem too. What does he mean by that?
Well, what happened in China, for example, after the, you know, the crash or bailout in the West, is that they powered ahead. The government pumped a load of money directly into the Chinese economy. They didn't just pump it into the stock markets in order to keep global demand up, which prevented a full-on crash. But of course, the problem with that is that those investments are ultimately dependent upon effective demand in the West. China basically sells most of its stuff to us. So if we haven't got any money, they ultimately pay the price because then we're their customers and they can't get around that. They haven't sufficiently moved towards a domestic demand-led economy because they haven't got free trade unions. Wages have risen in China, but not by enough. And we're now on the brink of the crash that was going to happen in 2008 and was going to happen in 2001, and in fact probably was going to happen in 1982 when the first of these crises erupted. And every time what's happened is that they've printed money and kicked the can down the road in the hopes that they could keep capitalism
functioning. Okay, so last week we talked about RBS's doomsday prophecy. Société Générale de Belgique and Standard Chartered Bank have already seconded what they're saying. Take all your money out of stocks and shares and take it out now.
Yeah, but there's still some hope on the trading floors that they are going to they're going to have another binge of money printing, particularly the European Central Bank. The Federal Reserve may decide to cancel the increase in interest rates, or marginal increase in interest rates that they've brought forward. And there's some hope also. I mean, don't forget, many of these traders have never seen a crash. You know, they've been working in the market for the last 7 or 8 years, and they've never seen a crash. And in fact, the crashes used to be, you know, fairly regular phenomenon in the 19th century. And because of macroeconomic management, people then got the idea that crashes were rather, you know...
But, I mean, surely crash is something we would point at 1929 as a crash. You're saying that used to happen quite a lot in the previous century.
Yeah, well, you used to get lots of... I mean, the mechanisms that cause crashes... There's a broad agreement amongst all economists about what causes them. Hayekian economists on the free market right, Keynesian economists in the centre, and Marxist economists on the left, they're all pretty clear about how crashes are formed. There are some free market economists who don't believe that there are crashes, and that in actual fact the capitalist system is wonderfully secure and it never has any kind of hiccups. But that, frankly, they're not serious. So everybody agrees about how crashes are formed, but it's the conclusions you draw from that. The Hayekians, the free marketeers, they think that crashes are inevitable. But they're like having a cold, like the one I've got at the minute, and you have to have the cold, and then you get better, and everything improves. Keynesians pointed out that yes, but you could carry on having a cold virtually indefinitely, and it never improves. And Marxists point out, well, this could be pneumonia, and that in actual fact, it's not a cold; you're going to die unless you change completely what you're doing. So they've all, you know, on one level, they all agree about how it works, but it's the conclusions you draw from that. I think this is the biggest credit bubble in history, by far. Bigger than the one that crashed in 2008. Far bigger.
What about 1929?
It was much smaller. That was a catastrophic crash that led to millions of unemployed all over the world and a world war.
We're also in the situation
now... What we're facing up to now is worse than 1929 by several orders of magnitude.
We're also in a situation now where people can make a lot of money out of these if they've got some kind of insider dealing,
if you put your derivative bets in the right way, you can make a fortune out of it. And that's what happens in crashes. The wealthy take their money out of the stock market and put it into gold or whatever, and everybody else is left with nothing.
Okay, 5 million jobs, they're saying at Davos, have been lost to artificial intelligence, or will be, by 2020. I mean, they're already being lost right now. I suppose this is one of the things they're talking about there, is that actually we don't really need people anymore. We've got factories to do our stuff, to make money for us, and we're needing people. We've got computers, and we need them less and less.
Yeah, but
people are a bit of a... We were talking about this in the first hour, weren't we, about the migrant crisis. Human beings are becoming a bit of a burden on the super rich.
Well, except that, ultimately, those people are your customers. Computers don't go shopping.
Well, not when they're... but people don't have that purchasing power anymore.
No, they don't. And there's a solution to that. You lend them money at interest.
They're not going to, because...
Well, they have been lending them money at interest. Private debt in the US and in Britain has been going up since the crisis. And we've had public austerity, which hasn't actually reduced the debt, but has squeezed the deficits. But private debt has been increasing. But there's a limit to that. You can lend people money to buy stuff, but then they've got to pay that money back. And we are now going to have a wave of debt deflation, which the mainstream textbooks don't recognise. Can you believe the mainstream textbook theory is that there's no problem with debt? Because if I owe you money, Tony, and I'm in debt and I can't pay, I will pay you, and you know, it's just a transfer of money from me to you. In actual fact, of course, debt is a real problem all over the world. Countries, companies and individuals are in massive debt, and that debt can't be paid. And the only way to cancel that debt now is for that's what crashes do. They cancel all the debts. But of course, it means that everybody's put out of work, and by the time they get back into work, you've gone to war with Russia, you've gone to war with China, there's millions dead, etc., etc. That's the danger we face. That we are going to have a crash and a world war, which is going to make World War II look like a walk in the park. And if you're living in Syria, you can probably imagine what that might look like.
I don't imagine it will touch Switzerland like most of these world wars.
One of the problems we have is that the super rich think that because they live in Switzerland, etc., that it won't affect them. And I think they're wrong. delusionary.
Well, I'm sure World War II did affect the Swiss a bit, but not that much. Calling the transformation the fourth industrial revolution, the World Economic Forum said that though employment may grow in certain areas, a net loss of more than 5 million jobs in 15 major developed and emerging economies can be expected up till 2020. This is a fourth industrial revolution, but it doesn't involve people, does it?
Yeah, but this is the contradiction. We've now invented such clever machines that they can do all of our work for us. And instead of being liberated so that we can say, phew, we don't have to work so hard anymore, we've got these computers to do it all, we're actually thrown out of work and replaced by the computers, and the whole economy is thrown into turmoil.
Is there any clear thinking, do you think, around the world that's actually taken this on board and said, well, actually what we need is far, far less working hours for everybody?
We need a planned economy.
Because the opposite is happening, isn't it?
We're finding
that quite often you've got both partners in a marriage working, and still they can't afford to get a house, get a mortgage. I mean, it's just a ridiculous situation.
Well, ultimately, what we've got to do is redistribute wealth from the 1% to the majority.
And is there any prospect of that? Not at Davos, maybe.
Well, no, but I mean, the problem is that the political power of the 1% is enormous. I'm astonished, frankly, at the way they've been able to get away with what's happened since 2008. That should have been the end of all of this free market nonsense theory, but it hasn't been. They're still talking it, but ultimately, even they can see that there is no future in a our technology has now outstripped the political and economic structures in which it's been born. In other words, capitalism is past its sell-by date. It will have to go, and a new system will have to be set up, which will be, I would suggest, about 60-70% publicly owned and with a residual private sector. That's what the future will look like if we can get through the crash and the World War.
The Swiss Army has 4,500 troops on duty defending the World Economic Forum from possible protests or whoever else.
Well, that's why they have it in Davos, because it's up the top of a mountain in Switzerland. How many activists can afford to travel to Switzerland and go on a very expensive Swiss train up to the top of a mountain to protest?
How would you compare these Davos conferences, which are reported quite a lot on the mainstream press, to Bilderberg, which is a little bit later in the year? This year, I think it's going to be in the United States, and we're at about end of May, beginning of June time. But what's the difference between the two?
Well, Davos, frankly, is more of a schmooze fest. I mean, Angela Merkel and Putin have just said we can't be bothered to go, we've got more important things to do. I was reading that to attend Davos can cost up to £100,000 just to attend, so it's not really for the likes of you and me, is it? The rich and powerful have their various places where they get together. Bilderberg one, Davos another, G8 summits, G7 summits now. And no doubt, there are meetings of the Trilateral Commission and so on and so forth, which are not very highly publicised.
OK, a couple of changes there have been over Christmas at Bilderberg, because, I mean, one of the things they always trumpet, the Bilderbergers, for those that haven't come across Bilderberg before, they are a transatlantic elite, really. Bankers, royalty, oil barons, media barons that meet up in secret every year, they say. We meet up only once a year. It's our only event. Well, it isn't, because a couple of times now there's been leaks of a winter meeting of the Bilderberg Steering Committee. A few years ago, some bright spark in Italy got some photographs of all these top Bilderberg people turning up at a hotel, and he was told by the staff, yes, it's a Bilderberg conference, but it was an unannounced one, just of the Steering Committee. And there's been some big changes over the holidays, Martin. Now on the Steering Committee is Eric Schmidt from Google, and also Sir John Sawers from MI6, now on the Bilderberg Steering Committee. I just wonder what you think from the sort of high-tech, super-tech firms and MI6 now being on the Steering Committee of Bilderberg, in what way that might change their plans for us in the future, of at least the plans for the economic life. I mean, I think it's probably fair to say that Will Hutton did one of the best descriptions of them. He said basically these people are the high priests of globalisation, and they're based in almost exclusively in the NATO countries.
Yeah, well, what you've got is various more and more secret groups. So the open Bilderberg it wasn't open because for years they denied they existed, but the Bilderberg meeting is basically, it's not where anything much is decided. People go to that meeting to be told what to do by the people who really make the decisions. And the people who really make the decisions meet in meetings that we don't know much about.
I think Hannah Borno it was that got some rather wonderful photographs from the last couple of Bilderberg meetings of George Osborne, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, sitting down with his arms crossed, looking a little bit feeble, being instructed by some of these big central bankers, people like Goldman Sachs, for example.
Well, the person who he was being instructed by was a former British civil servant who was obviously extremely powerful. The name escapes me, but it was quite clear because of the photographs that Osborne was not in a dialogue with this chap. Osborne was being told what he was going to do, even though he's the British Chancellor of the Exchequer. And of course Osborne at one stage claimed that it was a private meeting and therefore he didn't have to account for what he was doing there, even though he'd taken all of his top civil servants from the Treasury with him to take notes at our expense. Let's not kid ourselves. I mean, there is a transnational global elite. It's a few hundred people, very powerful people. They all know each other and they do plot and plan to get what they want out of things. They didn't get where they are today by doing anything else, did they?
Goldman Sachs, though, taking a great deal of interest in what's happening with the EU at Davos, etc. And they are effectively running. I mean, they've been technocrat governments in many of the countries that have been victims of the Eurozone crisis. What's Goldman Sachs' role in all this?
Well, they are very key. I mean, what's it, was it Nouriel Roubini or somebody else? It was Matt Taibbi said that they're like a vampire squid on the face of humanity, sucking whatever money they can get out of us. They are a particularly pernicious organisation, but I don't suppose they're the only ones in the game. It's astonishing how many senior people in governments around the world are former Goldman Sachs, and in places like the IMF and so on. It's very much the place of the movers and shakers, even though, of course, if you'd followed through market principles in 2008, they would have been liquidated and bankrupted, a bit like Tata Steel or, anything else that you can imagine, British Leyland or whatever. They should just have been liquidated, but they weren't. They're still there. They're still doing their stuff. Because the state, they're that powerful that they're able to use the state and its resources to protect their private interests.
Despite being too big to fail, America's most important bank, Goldman Sachs, may have done so this week, at least for a few minutes, when it possibly tipped off a new economic recession. A slide in the markets do not take it easy to start the year report posted online showed the US in a recession, according to Goldman's current activity indicator, although EM assets remain in the crosshairs and the outlook there remains tenuous in spots. Growth concerns have impacted the market's view of US and European growth as well. I mean, this is basically a graph, Martin, showing that we are heading down, just as we were in 2007 and early 2008, right now, below the zero line, basically.
Yeah, well, Goldman Sachs, of course, got themselves reclassified as a bank so that they could have money under the TARP program. Because, of course, they were supposedly a hedge fund, and there's no, hedge funds should just go bust. You know, if they're stupid and they invest in the wrong things, you just go bust. Goldman Sachs didn't go bust because they were reclassified as a bank so they could get loads of US taxpayer money, which they got. And they're still there at the heart of our zombie banking system. But in actual fact, as right-wing economists from the von Mises Institute or left-wing economists like Steve Keen will tell you, the whole system is bankrupt. And at some point, it's going to crash. And then people are going to ask questions. Why is it that you have got billions and I've got nothing? Is it because you're so much cleverer and better than I am and you invented a better widget? Or have you just got, we just got all the goodwill and you've got all the artillery? And I think that question, people want capitalism to work. They want to believe in it. That's why we probably got a majority for the right in the last British general election, because people don't like change. They'd rather stick with what they know. But once capitalism has imploded, then that change is the only thing that people will have to look at. That will be the only thing to talk about. We're going to have to change the system, period.
How?
Well, ultimately, this money hasn't disappeared. The assets necessary to create a decent life for everybody exist. The resources exist. The technology is improving all the time. So why is it that we can't solve problems of poverty and unemployment?
I mean, in a way, Mark Wright in the first hour hit the nail on the head. He said basically power's been being concentrated away from local cities like ours into Westminster, and then from there on to Brussels. Exactly the same sort of thing
in the
US. Well,
he's only talking about political power. Real power, financial power, has always been concentrated in a small number of hands, and it's getting even more concentrated. Oxfam's report this week shows that, you know, that 60 individuals now own more than whole of the half of humanity, and it used to be 80 individuals, and before that it was 100. But it's the bailout since 2008 has led the ultra rich to be even richer than they were before the crisis. So for them, there is no crisis. This is just a money making opportunity. But this is not capitalism where James Watt invents a steam engine. It's like capitalism in Russia in the 1990s, where if you're in the right position, you can end up owning the steel industry.
Well, someone steals his steam engine, bangs him over the head and exploits it for him because they've got so much intelligence, so much power.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's move on a little bit to look at some of the other international issues. And Angus Robertson from the SNP brought up Yemen at Prime Minister's Questions this week.
Angus Robertson!
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Mr. Speaker, thousands of civilians have been killed in Yemen, including a large number by the Saudi Air Force.
That's right.
And they've done that using British-built planes with pilots who are trained by British instructors who are dropping British-made bombs and are coordinated by the Saudis in the presence of British military advisors. Isn't it time for the Prime Minister to admit that Britain is effectively taking part in a war in Yemen that is costing thousands of civilian lives, and he has not sought parliamentary approval to do this?
I think the right honourable gentleman started in a serious place, but then seriously wandered off. Look, it's in our interest. It's in our interest that we back the legitimate government of Yemen, and it's right to do that. We have some of the most stringent arms control measures of any country anywhere in the world. But just to be absolutely clear about our role, we're not a member of the Saudi-led coalition. British military personnel are not directly involved in the Saudi-led coalition's operations. Personnel are not involved in carrying out strikes, directing or conducting operations in Yemen, or selecting targets, and we're not involved in the Saudi targeting decision-making process. But yes, do we provide training and advice and help in order to make sure that countries actually do obey the norms of humanitarian law? Yes, we do.
Well, so the Saudis are deciding where the bombs drop, but we are also providing them with many of their targets, apparently. Now, I wonder how many of the civilian targets we've been providing them with, Martin. I mean, just looking at, it's nearly a year since this assault by the Saudis on Yemen, one of the oldest civilizations on the planet, one of the poorest countries in the world, began. And we're now looking at over 8,000 deaths and 25,000 casualties, people injured by this bombing campaign, and it doesn't seem to be any end in sight to it.
Yeah, well, I think the Prime Minister's response there was entirely disingenuous, and I take my hat off to Angus Robertson for bringing this issue up, because it's something that really people really need to understand. Now, we are either directly helping the Saudis, or we're just providing them with the wherewithal so that they can carry out their own atrocities. There's a blockade going on Yemen, and Yemen is one of the countries in the world that's 90% dependent on imports for its food.
Another important statistic here is the UN has said something like around about 93% of the casualties in Yemen have been civilians.
Well, also, I find it extraordinary that the Prime Minister can refer to the legitimate government of Yemen. Now, there's lots of people in Yemen who would dispute that, but is the Saudi Arabian government legitimate? Assad is legitimate. He has won a general. He won a general election in Syria in the most difficult circumstances less than 18 months ago. The Saudi regime has no legitimacy, and what we said in Libya and in Syria was that regimes that are not legitimate, we're not even going to go for a slow reform over time. Like, you've got to remove yourself from power slowly. If you stand in the way, we are going to support people who will take up arms and kill you, like Gaddafi was killed on YouTube. tube with a bayonet up his backside and a bullet through the head by the insurgents, many of whom people, many people think that they were actually French special forces. But that is not the rule of law, is it? But it's a necessary thing to make Libya free. Gaddafi's got to die. As Hillary Clinton said, we came, we saw, he died. Ha ha ha. All I can say to that is the ruler of Saudi Arabia is absolutely up for that, because we're not having any rules anymore. It's absolutely okay to kill heads of state like that, and that goes for Western heads of state too. So the two IRA attempts to kill Margaret Thatcher and John Major, absolutely legitimate under those rules.
But Gaddafi wasn't killed by British forces, was he?
He was killed by insurgents being armed and trained by British forces, and the RAF were bombing his troops. And, of course, if the Libyans were like the Germans, perhaps they would have hit back and killed some people in Britain. Because, ultimately, that's where we're going with all of this. If British people think it's OK to stick our finger in Yemen and kill thousands of civilians, some young Yemeni is going to come back here and say, take some of your own medicine. I'm not saying I approve of it. I'm just saying it's as night follows day.
Also, looking abroad, the Falkland Islands, Sir Nigel Dodds put a question to Prime Minister David Cameron at PMQs this week.
Sir Nigel Dodds.
Will the Prime Minister reiterate, not just on behalf of the government, but speaking for the whole of the House, I believe, the unconditional and unequivocal support of the British people for the people of the Falkland Islands to their right to their inalienable and British-held right to self-determination, and that that will not be undermined in any way by some kind of accommodation or some kind of negotiations in which the people of the Falkland Islands may have an enormous say but have no veto. They should have a right to determine their own future.
The Honourable Gentleman has put it better than I ever could. The people of the Falkland Islands have spoken as clearly as they possibly could in that referendum, and they want to maintain the status quo. And as long as they want that, they have that guaranteed from me. And I find it quite extraordinary that the Labour Party now want to look at trying to change the status and give away, you know, something people absolutely consider to be their right. And that will never happen as long as I'm in Downing Street.
Well, there's a lot of mischief makers going on. There's a quite simple solution to this crisis. There's a massive oil field just off the Falkland Islands. Now, if we want the Falkland Islands to remain British, we go to the new right-wing government in Argentina, who've got the same line as the previous left-wing government, that they want the islands back, and we say, right, we keep the islands, and the British citizens who live there carry on being British citizens, although we're all paying £1 million a head to keep them that way. I mean, we're talking about people on benefits and all the rest of it. The Falkland Islands are a massive drain on our resources, but the Argentinians, who have got a big population, many of them very poor, they can have the oil field. But you know what? The British military and the British government and the British multinational companies, they want that oil field. And at some point, the Argentinians are going to say, no, it's our oil field, it's on our continental shelf, it's closer to our waters than the North Sea is to your waters, we want that oil field. And with the obvious deal to do is we keep the Falkland Islands, we keep the British flag flying, we keep spending money on paying welfare payments to the Falkland Islanders, but the Argentinians can have the oil field because it ain't worth fighting about.
Also, this week, as I promised at the top of the hour, we're going to look at some more information that's come out recently about the Malaysian airline of Boeing 777, MH370, and the aircraft's installed systems. Now, this is a chap called Peter Myers, who apparently has got much of this information from somebody who's an aviation expert who didn't want to be named, but he's saying effectively the active communication systems were turned off in this aircraft over a period of at least 15 minutes. Only someone with a clear knowledge of the aircraft systems and the location of the equipment would know how to achieve this aim, including the pilots. If they were responsible for this gradual disablement of the systems, why did it take them 15 minutes to do it?
Well, I mean, this is a technical question that I haven't really looked into, is the honest answer to that. I'm very suspicious about all of these missing aeroplanes, especially because they're Malaysian. Malaysia has, in fact, become a target for Western destabilisation. It's quite possible some skullduggery took place here, but I don't know enough about it to be firm in my views.
One of the other things with the aircraft is it was going from waypoint to waypoint. It was being flown, consciously navigated from one spot to another in a kind of zigzag pattern, rather like the 9/11 aircraft.
Well, indeed. And, of course, the MH17 shootdown, which happened that in the similar before that. I mean, I think all the evidence that I've been reading suggests that that was definitely shot down by fighters from Kiev. But nobody really wants to talk about that, because that was definitely a provocation, probably carried out by elements within the Kiev government working with our own intelligence service.
One of the things,
killing all those innocent people.
One of the important things Peter Myers is saying is that Rolls-Royce made the initial announcement that the engines were communicating via ACAS satellite systems for 5+ hours after the initial disappearance. What caused Rolls-Royce to clam up about what they knew? Threats from the US? No more engine sales to the US market, maybe. And he's saying, from his perspective as an aviator, Rolls-Royce knows exactly where this flight landed, but they won't say anything.
Well, that's probably what we're looking at here, isn't it? They inadvertently let the cat out of the bag, and they had their toes stamped on.
The implication here is that this is a possible... I mean, there's quite a lot of evidence here. I'll put a link up on the show page at thisweek.org.uk to this report from Peter Myers. But he's saying effectively that all the evidence points towards this landing at Diego Garcia. Now, there's a massive problem with that. It's British-owned Chagos Islands territories, and the US run it. And there's a big campaign, actually, constantly. I hear little bits and pieces about this. For the Chagos Islands to be given their islands back.
Yes, and unlike the Falkland Islands, we didn't go to war to get their islands back. We kicked them off the island and said, no, it's British, you can get lost because you've got brown skins, unlike the people in the Falkland Islands who've got white skins. Incidentally, the military government in Argentina, which killed 30,000 of its people, was backed 100% by the British and the Americans before the invasion of the Falkland Islands. Anybody going to be held to account for any of that? No, of course not.
The pilot practiced landing at a military airfield, Diego Garcia, using his private simulator. But, hey, who knows how many practice landings he accomplished? Bearing in mind his marital problems, I wonder how many US dollars it would take to get him to acquiesce in the US Navy hijacking via the Global Hawk system. Apparently, these aircraft could be easily hijacked.
Well, we all know that. I mean, it looks like the aircraft on 9/11 were hijacked from the ground by a Global Hawk technology, which has been around since the 1970s.
Okay, Martin, time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 7 now. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Lib Dem Councillor for Cabot Ward, Mark Wright. Our sister show Dialects dropped from BCFM, hopefully back soon, still available as a podcast at dialectradio.co.uk. This week you can hear an update about the Ukraine and how the US government's changed the law to allow fascist paramilitaries to receive Pentagon funding.